A battle has begun over who should pay for the billions of dollars in wildfire damage. The outcome could change utility bills, it could spike your insurance rates, or even prompt lawsuits. On Inside, Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler talks with me in this week's Capital Chat about what's at stake. And there's a new poll that asks voters about the issues they care about most in the California governor's race. We'll talk about that, too. Also today, Governor Brown has had more than a year to fill the open seat on the California Supreme Court, but he hasn't. And that's complicating a pension case that he wants resolved. A court specialist explains what's happening. Later in the hour, new jazz releases chosen by Cap Radio jazz music director Gary Vercelli. That's in this week's Sound Advice. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Hearings have begun in Sacramento to address who should be responsible for the billions of dollars in damages from California wildfires. Depending on the eventual outcome, utility customers could end up with a spike in bills, insurance rates could jump. There could also be lawsuits as homeowners and business owners try to recover losses. And that's where we begin this week's Capital Chat, which I recorded earlier this morning with Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler. I asked Ben to start by outlining the hearing that started yesterday and noting the players who are involved.
The hearing held yesterday was by a brand new legislative conference committee, that's Joint Senate and Assembly, on essentially on wildfire liability, though they seem to call it wildfire preparedness and recovery. The big thing at stake here are these billions of dollars of damages year after year after year with California's changing climate, the new normal, as Jerry Brown has called it, and what should be done? Because you have on one side utilities like PG&E and their employee unions arguing that the status quo is not sustainable. There is a system right now where utilities are responsible for paying the damages. They're liable. Even if utilities are found to not be negligent, as long as their equipment played a role in the spark that began a fire. On the other side, you've got insurance companies, trial lawyers, cities, counties, ratepayer groups. And by ratepayer groups, I'm talking about groups that advocate on utility rates, although they say they're concerned also for just property owners who, because many ratepayers own property too, of course. Among ratepayers, you've also got, you know, businesses and ag industry folks as well, because they pay electricity and they have property insurance too. So their argument is you can't just bail out the utilities here, that there needs to be, if you're going to mess with the system, which they say is okay as it is, you've got to find something that doesn't just shift all this multi-billion dollar liability over to regular folks.
In the story, the reporting that you've been doing, you gave a specific example being the Tubbs fire last year. Could we talk through an example like that so we get a sense of the numbers, the damages, and where some of the finger pointing is?
So the Tubbs fire is one of those huge fires last year, last October, in wine country, right, in Napa, Sonoma, that area. There were other fires in that area in that same month that have already come back with the report from CAL FIRE that PG&E equipment played a role in the spark that caused the fire. We're still waiting for the Tubbs report, but because there's, what, $5 to $7 billion worth of estimated damages so far on that wildfire, if those costs were to be passed on to PG&E ratepayers, which PG&E could ask the Public Utilities Commission to do, and the Public Utilities Commission would say yes, if PG&E is found to have caused the fire, if it was not negligent. If, for example, a branch from a tree blew in, for, you know, let's say PG&E cleared defensible space around its power line and a tree branch blew in from, you know, way away, and there really wasn't, in theory, much that PG&E could have done about it, PG&E could ask for ratepayers to have the cost. That would be another $20 to $30 a month per ratepayer. That's a lot of money.
$20 to $30 a month. Wow.
And otherwise, shareholders would be stuck with all of this. And so let me play a piece of tape from Mark Joseph, who's a Bay Area lawyer who represents utility employee unions, And his point is, look, we're trying to get, you know, PG&E is supposed to make all these investments in infrastructure and, you know, to help reduce the future risk of wildfires. Well, how do you do that if shareholders have to shell out all of this money for wildfire damages?
We want to make sure that the utilities can make the investments to reduce the chance of creating new victims. To do that, the utilities have to raise billions of dollars every year, and no one is going to invest in a company that has uncontrolled liability. To do this, we need to change inverse condemnation. We applaud the leadership of the governor for making a very sound proposal, and we look forward to working on this with the committee.
This inverse condemnation is a really complicated term, but basically it's this doctrine, this under California law and state Supreme Court rulings that, look, utilities are responsible, they're liable if their equipment helps cause a fire, even if they weren't negligent.
He made reference to the governor's proposal, so let's talk about that. There was a bill crafted by the governor's office, and in fact, news of it already spiked shares of PG&E, Edison International, and Sempra once the announcement was made. Will you explain?
Yeah, and that may have been at least part of the governor's point, because I'm not entirely convinced that the governor's proposal has a lot of, or at least the part about inverse condemnation has a lot of support in the legislature right now. So the governor he did propose, you know, tougher standards for, you know, wildfire safety plans and tougher penalties for utilities if they don't keep up with them. But the key part of the proposal that drew praise from utilities and, as we heard a moment ago, the unions, and that has drawn very sharp criticism from insurers and trial lawyers and ratepayers groups alike, is this effort to change this inverse condemnation piece of law. And what it would do is say, look, a court would decide if PG&E had acted reasonably. And that's, you know, again, we're kind of getting into were they reasonable in the actions they took to try to prevent a fire from starting at this particular location, or did they drop the ball? And then a court would decide how much proportionally PG&E is responsible, right? So instead of being 100% responsible or 0% responsible, somewhere in between. And then, you know, if you take the Tubbs fire as an example, and by the way, I should say that the governor's proposal is forward looking from January 1, 2018 onwards. So
right.
The 2017 fires,
it
including
would not
the Tubbs.
Apply to any
exactly.
fires last year. Yeah.
Exactly. But if we use that as an example, let's say there's a $7 billion, let's pick a nice round number,
five.
let's say $10 billion, right? And let's say, you know, the PG&E is 50% responsible. Well, they'd be on the hook for $5 billion in damages, not $10 billion. And then, you know, if you're someone who lost their home in a fire, you might be able to sue PG&E for half of your home's value, but the insurance company is not, you know, then you have to deal with the insurance company and insurers. I mean, are they going to necessarily want to pay out the other half? And you're going to have to go into court rather than right now under inverse condemnation. Utilities tend to, I'm told, settle fairly quickly in the legal process because, you know, they're not necessarily going to get a shot at winning. But under this, then they could go into court. It would slow down. In theory, utilities could drag things out in court because they've got more money than property owners to deal with the lawsuit. So there's the utilities and their unions are happy with the governor's proposal. Trial lawyers, insurers, ratepayer groups, other industries are not.
One aspect that we haven't talked about is the federal money. And I don't know what the role of federal disaster funds are in this. I haven't seen it in your reporting, Ben, but I'm going to raise that question because we hear about the allocation of federal money at the time of a fire. What about now in the aftermath and the discussion of damages?
So I don't have a clear answer for you on that. It's a good question and not one I've had a chance to study yet. But my best guess for the moment is that those costs are often used to fight the fires. You've got all of these costs that Cal Fire and the U.S. Forest Service and local fire departments that respond through mutual aid requests. I mean, it costs money to fly those helicopters into fire zones and to actually fight those fires and to provide food and lodging for
right,
the firefighters.
Right, immediate housing for people who are displaced in the time of the emergency. Right?
Yes, and so I suspect that the federal funds and state general funds, which go toward this too, probably first and foremost go there.
Okay, what happens next in this hearing process? What are some of the eventual scenarios?
Well, I think the big question is this one surrounding inverse condemnation and what will happen with it. You could see, you know, new standards for utilities to craft safety plans. And you know, I've heard some ratepayer groups make the point that PG&E needs some more skin in the game, or actually needs any skin in the game to incentivize them to do everything they can to reduce the risk of wildfires around their equipment. PG&E itself has told me, look, there's kind of a perverse disincentive right now. If we're going to be found liable, no matter what, you know, why should we spend money trying to reduce wildfire risk? I think that's one argument that might be made. Let me also play a quick piece of tape from the other side of the debate, the insurance side. This is Rex Frazier with the insurance industry, leads their lobbying group here in Sacramento.
Meanwhile, insurance companies, we're staying in communities, and we heard earlier the discussion about a unique legal environment. Our insurance rules are not only unique in the United States, they're unique in the world. There's nothing like California. And yet we stay here. We're not even allowed, as much as we're talking about climate change, we're not even allowed to use climate models in our rate-making process. But yet the argument is PG&E can't handle their climate risks, so let's dump their risks on other folks. It filters out to the insurance industry, and we can't even include climate risk in our rates.
And a point is that already the 2018 fire season is looking more intense than last year, and climate change seems to be going in that direction. So we don't know what we're in for, do we?
On the wildfire front, no. On the legislative front, session ends. Lawmakers adjourn for the year August 31st at midnight. And so I'm hearing that in order to get a conference committee report through all of the end of session deadlines, that the committee would have to vote on the conference report about a week before that. Probably means that a deal would need to be reached, you know, mid to late August, sometime like August 20 to 23, somewhere in there. That's all speculation. They could also come up with a completely separate bill and futz with it early in the final week of session to still beat the 3-day in print end of session deadline. But we will see. And we will also see, you know, whether inverse condemnation gets taken on or if that kind of gets punted to next year and the next governor and some of the easier, lower hanging fruit, if you will, issues are addressed instead.
I'm talking with Ben Adler in this week's Capital Chat. Before I let you go, Ben, there's a new statewide poll. It's been released, giving us some voter survey information in the California governor's race. The headline, though, isn't about who's in the lead. I found it very interesting to read about the issue that seems to be most important in voters making a choice for governor.
Well, we don't know if it's most important because it wasn't compared to all of the other issues on the table. But the environment, which is what this survey was about from the PPIC, is playing a big role in voters' choices. A majority in California want California to choose its own course, contrary to what the Trump administration is doing on the environment and climate change. Also, polls showing that Gavin Newsom and Dianne Feinstein hold significant leads, continue to, in their races for governor and U.S. Senate, respectively, over in the governor's race, John Cox, the Republican businessman, and in the Senate race, state senator, former Senate leader, Kevin DeLeon.
Okay, we'll post a link to that survey so that everybody else can see poll results. And Ben, I'm going to say thanks. Rather than going to the Capitol, I understand you're headed for jury duty, so good for you.
I have 8 minutes to make it to the courthouse. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks a lot, Ben.
Take care.
There's more state government news at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Capitol Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capitol Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In March of last year, California Supreme Court Justice Catherine Werdiger announced her retirement, and she officially stepped down last August. So for almost 1 year now, her seat has been open, at times filled by a rotation of other judges. And here's where it gets a little bit complicated. Governor Brown has delayed filling the seat. At the same time, he's asking the court to speed up its review of a major pension reform case. So we've asked attorney David Ettinger to walk us through the situation. He's an appellate specialist who writes the blog At the Lectern, and he's joining us by phone from L.A. Mr. Ettinger, thanks for joining us on Insight.
It's good to be with you, Beth.
How unusual is it that Governor Brown hasn't filled this open seat yet?
Well, his prior vacancies have taken a while to fill, but not nearly this long. So it's pretty unusual.
So let's get to why he hasn't. What political strategy is at play here?
Well, I don't know whether I'd call it a political strategy, but and nobody seems to have any inside information outside of the governor and maybe a couple of his advisors. But some of the speculation of late has been that he might be wanting to appoint one of his close advisors, and including his wife might be one of the ones who he wants to appoint. And he might be waiting for a couple of reasons. One is that if he waits to make the appointment until after the middle of August, the appointee would not have to face election until 2022 instead of this coming November. So that's one factor. And another factor might be that he wants to keep the advisor on his staff for as long as possible as his term is winding down.
So as a court watcher, David, what's your reaction to the speculation that Ann Gust Brown might be appointed to the high court?
Well, the governor has a history of making outside-the-box appointments that also turn out to be excellent choices, and that would seem to appointing Ann Gust Brown would seem to fall into that category. It would certainly be outside the box. But from what I've read about her, she sounds like she'd be very qualified and a good justice.
Meanwhile, the open seat has left six justices, and in some cases that would mean a 3-3 split in cases. I did mention this rotation of fill-in judges, so would you explain how that happens?
Sure. The court has a system for appointing temporary justices. They're called pro tem justices, and they are drawn from the Court of Appeal. There are somewhere over 100 Court of Appeal justices around the state, and the Chief Justice will take mostly on an alphabetical basis the justices from the Court of Appeal, as long as those Court of Appeal justices have been on the Court of Appeal for over a year. So it's generally alphabetical. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes a justice might not be available to sit on a particular case, and they'd be put on a later case. But that's generally how the system works.
I have read a number of your blog entries, and in the entry from July 18th, you do say that this long vacancy on the court has interfered with the work to some degree. How so?
Well, that's based on comments made by the Chief Justice herself, Chief Justice Tani Cantil-Sakaue. Back in December, she was quoted as saying it's difficult to operate without a seventh justice, and she said some cases were stuck due to 3-3 ties of the six regular justices on the court now. So if they don't have four justices agreeing on a particular disposition, they probably are not going to set the case for oral argument, and the argument has to precede the decision.
So now we come to the specific situation that I referred to, the governor asking the state Supreme Court to speed up a review of a lawsuit that challenges the 2013 Public Employee Pension Reform Act. Before we jump into the nuts and bolts of the process, would you explain this case a bit?
Well, I don't know. I'm not an expert on this at all, on the pension issues, but I do know it involves what's called the California rule, which, as I understand it, means that California workers are entitled to the pension benefits that were in existence when they were hired. And I believe the legislature passed, at Governor Brown's urging, some statutes to modify pension rules because of anticipated pension costs coming up in the future that could be debilitating for public entities.
We have then the governor not filling the open seat, but asking the court to expedite the pension cases, in fact, and the Chief Justice saying, we're already pushed and stressed because of the open seat. So what's going on here, David, and what's at stake for the governor?
Yeah, well, it is a bit ironic that the governor is keeping the Supreme Court waiting, keeping them shorthanded for almost a year now. And then he, on the other hand, he's saying, hurry up on this one case, it's important to me. I mean, standing alone, the request for preference and a quick disposition of the pension case seems like a reasonable request to make to the court, and it might be honored. It might move the case more quickly than it otherwise would. But just juxtaposed to his keeping the court shorthanded for so long, keeping the court waiting, it's just an ironic situation. And I have to mention there are two different pension cases. He made the request in one particular case called Cal Fire, but there's also another case, Alameda County Deputy Sheriff's Association, that's also raising pension issues. That's before the court, and not fully briefed yet. So it's possible the court might want to wait for that second case, the Alameda County case, to be fully briefed before it sets either one of them for argument.
Now I'm going to take us a little further into the weeds, and that is, if the court waits and puts the case on the back burner, and Governor Brown is no longer in office, and the governor has already replaced the attorney general in this case, and the governor's office has assumed a responsibility for it, but if he's no longer in office, do you know what happens, David? Does the case get kicked back to the attorney general's office, or does the new governor assume a role of responsibility?
That I'm not sure of. I would assume that it would stay within the governor's office, since the governor took over that case. And it would mean that whoever the new governor is might be able to make a change in legal position.
Exactly. You know,
that's just speculation on my part. But
it is valid to say that the governor's successor might be less willing to challenge organized labor or challenge the situation with pensions.
That's true. And that may be why the present governor is asking for a faster hearing on the Cal Fire case.
You're listening to attorney David Ettinger. He is an appellate specialist who blogs about the California Supreme Court for At the Lectern, practicing before the California Supreme Court. He has briefed and argued dozens of appeals, including more than a dozen arguments before the California Supreme Court. Can we go back to that point about the speculation of the next justice to be named to the California Supreme Court, and the fact that justices end up on the ballot? There are two who will be on the ballot this November. What's your thought about having elections for state Supreme Court justices?
Well, the California system is certainly better than a number of other states, because in California we do not have contested elections for Supreme Court or for Court of Appeal justice positions either. No lawyer or judge can take out papers and run against a sitting Supreme Court or Court of Appeal justice. Rather, those justices, when their 12-year terms are expiring, their names go on the ballot, and the voters are asked, should this judge have another 12-year term? And you just vote yes or no on that justice. So that's certainly better than the states where there are contested two candidates, sometimes partisan elections for court positions. It definitely reduces the politicization of those appellate judicial elections. That being said, I, for one, would favor getting rid of the elections altogether. There have been rare instances where judges have not been retained, just the prospect of having that, just the threat of not being retained, I think can create a negative influence on how the justices might be looking at a particular case. A former Supreme Court justice, California Supreme Court Justice Otto Kaus, said that these retention elections are like shaving in the bathroom with an alligator in your bathtub. He said, you always know it's there. That's the famous analogy that was made. I would favor taking the alligator out of the bathtub and letting the justices not have to worry about being retained.
I think most of us would prefer an alligator not to be in the bathtub, actually.
Yes. Yes.
Sorry. I had to play with that idea.
That was Justice Kaus's point, I think.
My mind is still rolling around the suggestion, the speculation of Anne Gust Brown becoming a justice on the California Supreme Court. So the way this could play out, and we're just speculating here, is if mm-hmm. Governor Brown waited until after August 30th to make the appointment, what's the process for her being confirmed or put in place, whatever the state process is? And then she wouldn't have to be on the ballot for that retention election until, I understand, 2022, correct?
That would be correct. The process for any Supreme Court appointment or nomination by the governor is that the appointee or nominee has to appear before the Commission on Judicial Appointments, which is a three-member panel made up of the Chief Justice of California, the Attorney General of California, and the senior presiding justice on the California Court of Appeal. So those three justices hold a hearing with the nominee or appointee, and then vote on whether to confirm the appointment or nomination. And so that's how Anne Gust Brown would get on the court, or whoever the appointment is.
Is there another name besides hers that's been high on the list?
Well, the original list, when the vacancy first opened up, was, the front runner speculation was about Presiding Justice Jim Humes on the California Court of Appeal in San Francisco. He was a close a deputy to Governor Brown when Governor Brown was Attorney General of the state. Humes would also be the first openly gay California Supreme Court justice. And he's also an extremely well-regarded jurist. So he was considered a front runner, but there doesn't seem to be a reason why the governor would have waited this long if he were going to appoint Justice Humes. So Another name that I've heard recently, again, based on no inside information whatsoever, is the senior advisor to the governor who's in charge of judicial appointments. And his name is Josh Groban, not the singer, but the same name. And he would also be one of those outside-the-box appointments that would probably be make an excellent justice.
Hmm. So we'd have to say, oh, that Josh Groban.
Yes, exactly.
Make a clarification. By the way, just to go back to the pension cases, I do want to note that it's been written that Governor Brown at a news conference has said that he does anticipate the court is going to uphold his law, that he anticipates that the California rule will be voided and that future leaders will be able to adjust pension benefits. There's a lot at stake. That could be posturing, but these are hugely significant cases for the present and maybe more importantly for the future.
They are indeed, and that's why the court might take this case up more quickly than it otherwise would. However, if for any reason they are split 3-3, the six justices, permanent justices on the court, I think they would probably want to wait and not have the a pro tem, a temporary justice, be the deciding vote on that case.
David, before I let you go, I want to really switch gears here and ask you about the court's decision to take something off the ballot, and that is the Three Californias initiative. We haven't really talked about that initiative on Insight, so you'll have to explain it just a bit, but it was notable that that's not going to be a question for voters.
It's at least not on this November's
right,
ballot.
Right, not this November.
Yeah, the court certainly left open the possibility of it being on a future ballot once they examine the validity of the initiative, whether it's a valid thing for topic for an initiative measure. And they did something quite similar just 4 years ago. There was a measure that was put on the ballot by the legislature to encourage a constitutional amendment to overturn the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United concerning campaign finance. And the Supreme Court took that off the ballot for which it had qualified. It then, at its normal pace, well, a little bit expedited, I'd say, but in a more leisurely pace, decided the case on its merits, said the ballot measure was fine, and it appeared on a ballot 2 years after it was originally scheduled to be on the ballot. So there's still the possibility that the Three California initiative could be on a later ballot.
If it passed, I'd be talking to you from a different state right now, wouldn't I?
Not as I understand it. As I understand it, that would only be the first of a number of steps towards Three Californias, because California can't unilaterally break itself up. Congress has to get involved as well.
Okay. And that was, by the way, Proposition 9, and there will be more discussion about it. David, we've covered a lot. I just want to ask before we close if there's anything else that is really piquing your interest in terms of watching the California Supreme Court right now, and anything you want to tell us to keep our eyes on.
Well, besides the pension cases, another case that's very significant that the court has agreed to hear concerns an examination of California's cash bail system. That's a case called In re Humphrey, and considering whether when a judge sets a bail, the judge has to take into account whether the defendant can afford to pay the bail, and that could be a very significant groundbreaking decision.
All right. Well, We may check back in with you about that one. But meanwhile, thanks so much for your time and for all your observation and information about the court. I appreciate the conversation, David.
It's been a pleasure.
That is David Ettinger. He is an appellate specialist. We're going to post a link to his blog. It's titled At the Lectern. And this is Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Steve Milne's in the newsroom with more headlines. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Beth. The Washoe County Health District says mosquito samples taken in southeast Reno have tested positive for the West Nile virus. It's the first time this year the virus has been confirmed in Washoe County. Samples were taken in the DeMonte Ranch and Hidden Valley areas. Crews will now step up mosquito surveillance and early morning insecticide fogging in the South Meadows area. Most people infected with West Nile don't show any symptoms, but about 1 in 5 develop a fever, headache, body aches, vomiting, diarrhea, or a rash. The Centers for Disease Control says about 1 in 150 people develop severe illness affecting the central nervous system. In rare cases, it can result in death. A heat advisory is in effect for Sacramento, Stockton, Modesto, Grass Valley, Jackson, and other cities throughout the Sacramento and San Joaquin Valleys and the Shasta Lake area. A heat advisory means that a prolonged period of hot temperatures is expected and will create a situation in which heat illnesses are possible. National Weather Service says people should drink plenty of fluids, stay in air-conditioned rooms, stay out of the sun, and check up on relatives and neighbors. Today's expected to be the hottest day of the week with a high temperature in Sacramento of 107. Overnight lows will only be in the mid to upper 60s. The heat advisory ends Friday night at 8. And the California State Fair continues for another 4 days at Cal Expo in Sacramento. Fair organizers are trying to be cooler by beating the heat. The fair admits that attendance has decreased 2 consecutive years in part because of the hot weather. This year, they've designed or designated 20 cool spots throughout Cal Expo. They include buildings with air conditioning, cooling stations, and full-body misters. More than 673,000 people attended last year's fair, which was a decrease of 5% from the year before. And the last day for this year's fair is this Sunday. Follow us on Twitter at Cap Radio News.
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Kennedy Center honors were announced yesterday. They include an award for jazz saxophonist and composer Wayne Shorter. He's now 84 years old. He's the winner of 10 Grammys. He and the other honorees will be recognized at the 41st Kennedy Center Honors event on December 2nd in Washington, D.C. And now we're going to keep you in the jazz mood a bit. Cap Radio Jazz host Gary Vercelli is joining me for this week's Sound Advice. Hi, Gary. Have you ever seen Wayne Shorter perform?
I have a number of times. Yeah. In fact, I got a chance to interview him in Italy when I was covering a jazz festival there. And he's quite an interesting person. He's been on the scene for a long time, and I think the word I could use to describe him best is prolific. He was just a prolific composer during the 60s. Art Blakey wanted him in his band because he wrote so well, and then Miles Davis stole him away. And simultaneously to both those gigs, Wayne was writing a lot of music as a leader for Blue Note Records. So He's just like a very prolific composer.
We'll hear some of his music at the end of the segment, but let's start with some new releases.
We've got some great new releases. This is the Verve Jazz Ensemble. This group was originated as a quartet back in 2006, and now they've expanded to a quintet and even a septet on certain tunes. Melodic content is real important to this group, and they've rearranged a lot of classic tunes written by Benny Golson and Lee Morgan, but we're going to hear one written by Lalo Schifrin. Thank you.
Who's the trumpet soloist?
That's Tatum Greenblatt, and the flutist was Alexis Torrentino. She's the newest member of the band. So.
Yeah, in honor of Devin Yamanaka, I have to ask about the flutist, right?
Yes, we all hear Devin practicing around the stage.
I know.
She's quite good, too.
Quite a jazz fan. So again, that's the Verve Jazz Ensemble, and the recording or the album is?
Connect the Dots.
Okay, good start.
Up next is Charles Lloyd's latest album with the group The Marvels. It's a multi-generational band. Charles is now 80 years old, but he's a young spirit.
Gary, about a single note. That piece started with that da da, and just in the first note or the timing of the two notes, I'm already set somewhere different in my soul than the first selection.
He's got a spiritual element to his playing. You know, Charles was rising in the 60s. He toured the Soviet Union, and he was on par with Miles Davis in terms of popularity as a jazz artist to the general public. And then he went off to Big Sur and kind of went on retreat and was off the scene for about 10 years and then resurfaced with this band. It's not too often you hear a pedal steel guitarist backing up a saxophonist in jazz, but Charles been blending jazz with other elements ever since he grew up in Memphis playing with blues bands at a young age.
I wonder, let me ask our engineer, Anthony, if you could start that clip again and see if you're with me on this. Just listen to those first two notes and see if they don't just put you somewhere. Right?
Maybe back to Big Sur meditating.
Am I right?
Yeah. What I notice when I hear two notes from Charles Lloyd is that's Charles Lloyd.
Yeah. You're listening to, besides Charles Lloyd, Gary Vercelli and this month's Sound Advice. Gary is Cap Radio's jazz music director and the host of Acid Jazz Saturdays on the Cap Radio music station. All right, let's keep going.
This is a young entrepreneurial young man. His name is Corey Weeds. He's a tenor saxophonist who was influenced by Hank Mobley. And he wrote a grant and formed a big band and recorded it in Canada. But he's employing a lot of great New York-based musicians, including Steve Davis and Gary Simulian. And we're going to hear East of the Village, which is a really nice arrangement of a Hank Mobley composition. And it features a nice trumpet solo by Joe Magnarelli.
Lori Weed's Little Big Band.
Yeah, I like Joe Magnarelli. He plays really clean lines, and also that arrangement has feelings of modal jazz, but also has a swinging element too. So it's worthy of greater appreciation, I think.
All right, one more new release. I think this is a fun one, Gary.
This comes from Michika Fukumori. She's from Japan, but now lives in New York City. She's been studying with Steve Kuhn, who's an unsung hero of the idiom. He played with John Coltrane and has had several recordings out. He produced this album, and she's had three albums out on this same label, Summit Records, but this is her first solo album.
Quite a captivating quality to that.
Indeed. You know, Michika, according to the liner notes of some of her albums, took the advice of Oscar Peterson's father Oscar years ago. Learn classical music and let it be your vocabulary for jazz. Mm.
So her last name is spelled Fukumori, Fukumori.
Uh-huh.
And the album is?
Is Piano Images. Uh-huh.
Wonderful.
It's on a small but potent label, Summit Records. They put a lot of good stuff out.
Great music. Well, shall we go back around to where we began? Shall we hear a little Wayne Shorter to close the show?
Yeah, this is Speak No Evil from the album the same name on Blue Note Records. This was recorded on Christmas Eve in 1964. So there's a spiritual element to Wayne's music as well. But think about the fact that this is 54 years old.
Wow. So Wayne Shorter will be honored on December 2nd in Washington, D.C. as part of the 41st Annual Kennedy Center Honors. Gary, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. By the way, Charles Lloyd is also a jazz master by the NEA.
So we have two
jazz masters on the show today.
And if you'd like more information about Gary's selections, they'll be posted on our website. That is this week's Sound Advice, and that's Insight for today. Tomorrow is our monthly Insight Music Special, so thanks for joining us. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. We had help today from Evan Matzler. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer is Anthony Van Hook. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Enjoy this Wayne Shorter. We're back again tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.